Ephraim Kishon is the Art Buchwald of Israel. And recently he compiled a lexicon, a glossary of terms which are filed in the dispatches covering the Middle East, or spoken by the ambassadors engaged in diplomatic exchange about the Middle East. And this glossary, part of which I'd like to read to you, has a wonderful way of piercing through language to reality. We hear so much in these dispatches about world public opinion, which he defines as the force which prevented the Russians from invading Czechoslovakia. A Zionist is really defined as a Czech student demonstrating against the Soviet tanks. When you hear of a friend of Israel, you know that this is a foreign country, non-Israeli country, which contents itself with a sharp reprimand without sanctions for the time being. Socialism, he defines as a progressive ideology for the destruction of small nations lacking oil wells. An imperialist agent is a local Jew trying to stay as much alive as possible. Refugees, about 1 million Jews from Muslim countries who do not demand to be returned to their countries of origin. Jerusalem, the Jewish appellation of El Quds, the ancient historical bastion of Jordanian kings for the last 19 years. Direct negotiations, a diabolic invention for humiliating brave nations which oppose direct negotiations. Patriot, a man who cuts the throat of an 83-year-old night watchman. The Sixth Fleet, a mighty armada which by its very presence ensures a flourishing nightlife in the ports of Italy. Genocide, 2 years jail for Arab terrorists who threw bombs into a cinema. And the status quo, the situation which existed before the wars which the Jews won. Someone has defined humor as the ability to find a crack of light in the darkness of the everyday. It's a kindly sense which all of us have, but which not all of us cultivate, which permits us to accept the incongruities of life. Israel is very fortunate that it is the heir of our long history, a history during which the sheer necessity of survival has taught the Jew humor, an ability to take a little bit with a grain of salt, the stresses of the everyday, to look and find the humor in the incongruities of life, the crack of light in the darkness of the everyday. We've been here before. We've been the David to the Philistines of the world. We have been threatened by intractable enemies who mask their hate, their simple blood hate, as some kind of religious concern, some kind of noble activity. We know that after David kills Goliath, even though he remains the young man and Goliath remains the emissary of the mercenaries, the military, the world has a way of feeling that David has been unkind to the Goliaths of the world, and that public opinion, that most fickle of all commodities, moves back and forth with little concern for the realities, the moralities of the situation. Now, I don't propose this morning to speak about the value of humor to Jewish survival, though I do believe that the capacity for humor is one of the things that Israel has to be thankful for. And I don't want to preach to you about the need for steadiness, though obviously steadiness and courage are prime requirements of Israel and of the Jewish people throughout the world. Rather, my purpose today is quite simple. I'd like to look behind the few paragraphs in the news dispatches to look behind the black headlines and to see if we can't put the events of the Middle East into some kind of perspective, to see them as they really are rather than as they are refracted to us through the prism of the press. And I do so with deliberation, because I'm concerned that there is a growing feeling among our neighbors and to a certain degree among ourselves that the sheer weight of the enemy, the sheer size and number of the Arab world, will ultimately overwhelm Israel, that there is no ultimate security, no solution to the problems which confront her. A friend put it well. He said to me recently, I have the sense sometimes that I'm watching a Greek tragedy. I have nothing but respect for the courage of the hero. I empathize with his great struggle, but I have the feeling that there's always that pursuing, avenging fate, that ultimately the sheer weight of numbers, the implacable enemy, must somehow overwhelm. I make no claim this morning that the way that Israel must go is not a dangerous way and perhaps not a desperate way. But I do claim that it is not a dead end. And I'd like to try and make you understand my own feelings. How is it, in the first instance, that so many have come to feel that there is a ring of iron which is slowly being tightened around Israel? And whatever nobility, whatever courage, whatever bravery the Israelis show, ultimately that iron must clamp tighter and tighter until it shuts off the blood supply, until there's no survival. I suspect it's because we're constantly being barraged with speeches and headlines and pictures on the television, that they all underscore the black, the desperate qualities. What do we see? We see pictures of a supermarket in Jerusalem that has been bombed by the guerrillas. We see pictures of an apartment building in Haifa which has been reduced to rubble by a bomb planted by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. We see dispatches of terrorist men being trained at camps someplace in the Middle East or in China. We hear the brave talk of these men about a self-proclaimed war of attrition against Israel. We hear Nasser say over and over again, no peace, no negotiations. We heard him just 2 weeks ago turn down the latest in a long list of compromises by the West, seeking a solution, saying to them, war is inevitable. It's a direct quote. We must choose the path of blood and of victory and not the path of political solution. There is no solution in politics. We hear the reporters tell us of the constant daily infusion of sophisticated arms from the Soviet Union into the port of Alexandria to Egypt. We read of the tens of thousands of dollars sent each day by the oil-rich nations, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and Libya, into the war chests of Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, and of the Arab guerrillas. There seems no relief. The effect is cumulative. The effect upon us is worry, doubt, and wonder. Can Israel survive? Is the tide of history flowing inexorably against Israel? Is there any hope of security, peace for this little state of ours? All of us know that the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Agnew, has delivered himself of two rather partisan and narrow political utterances these last several weeks about the press and the television media. Within them, he has attacked the great news gathering networks, the New York Times and the Washington Post, attacked them for not being complimentary enough in their coverage of him and particularly of the administration. He has accused them of somehow manipulating the news to conform to their Eastern liberal line. Interestingly, he made no mention of the numbers of conservative editorial combines, the Scripps Howard papers, the Hearst papers, the Gannett Press, which throughout the great heartland of America control most of the news which is being dispensed. But in this rather partisan attack, Mr. Agnew, or a speechwriter, included one observation at least which has merit. He said that bad news drives out good news, that normalcy is the bane of the evening news, that 1 minute of Stokely Carmichael is worth 10 minutes of any conservative, serious black leader. Now, this has been true in the reporting of news from Israel quite as much as it's true in the reporting of news in the United States. The press, the television go for the incident, for the dramatic event, for the extreme statement, for the colorful slogan, and they blazon these across the pages or across the screen, and they become the news and have an effect in and of themselves. Let me give you the example from Israel. Israel is a country of 2.5 million people. Cleveland is, Greater Cleveland is a community of 2.5 million people. Would you believe, reading the papers, that there has been greater destruction of property due to violence in Cleveland in the last 12 months than in Israel? Would you believe that more people have died violently in Cleveland in the last 12 months than in Israel? Yet both of these are fact. We somehow get the impression, reading the press, that Israel is a beleaguered nation, that it is daily suffering from a terrible guerrilla incursion, that it is uptight. But anyone who has visited Israel knows that life goes on, and that the terrorists are a deadly nuisance, certainly, but little more than a nuisance. They are being handled, that most of the attackers are captured or killed long before they carry out their project. A reporter of the London Economist, Mr. Johnson, made this report on the guerrillas just a few weeks ago. The situation is by no means as serious as newspaper reporters suggest. Incidents are few and rarely fatal. It is true, for instance, that an American woman tourist was killed during a senseless attack on the Dead Sea Lido by Iraqi artillery. I had been in the very same spot myself only 3 days before. The Iraqis claimed that they had identified her as a CIA agent from a distance of several miles. But these murderous acts indicate Arab impotence. Neither their regular forces nor their terrorists constitute the smallest challenge to the Israeli occupation of the Arab territories. Civilians are nearly always the target, and often Arab civilians. The Al-Fatah recently bombarded Jericho because the Arab inhabitants refused to observe a general strike which they had ordered. Attacks on Israeli military positions by terrorists are rare and invariably fail. Few manage to penetrate Israeli-held territory, and fewer still return. They have yet to establish a single base, even of a temporary nature, on the Israeli side of the line. The terrorist groups, there are 12 rivals at the latest count, lack both the major qualifications of a successful resistance movement, the ability to secure the active cooperation of a substantial portion of the occupied population, and the means to shake the determination of the occupying power to remain. After 2 years of efforts, they have shown that they will never become more than terrorists, and have provoked even Al-Agham, Nasser's semi-official Cairo newspaper, to print the jibe that these groups spill more ink than blood. And that's a direct quote. And yet, our papers are filled, as they were again last night, with a picture of the shadow of a man jumping over what seems to be a bonfire. A picture claims to have been taken off Peking television and to identify an Al-Fatah terrorist being prepared for some kind of activity. And the results are clear. I picked up the paper this morning. The Plain Dealer columnist Liakos reporting from, writing his column from Washington, talking about the Arab refugees, claims in the first instance that there is an effective terrorist operation army in the field, and in the second instance, that this army represents the natural and accepted leadership of the Palestinians, of the refugees themselves. There is no effective El Fatah army in the field. In the recent invasion of Lebanon by the El Fatah, they were defeated at every major point by Arab troops who were unwilling to fire directly or to carry on pursuit operations. And more than that, these 12 competing groups are fighting with themselves for a kind of militant leadership of a Palestinian group which does not, in fact, accept the leadership of any one of these groups, or in fact, the leadership of the terrorist movement themselves. There is a strong, moderate Palestinian community, mostly on the West Bank, which has yet to be heard from, which has made conversation with the Israelis and other powers about creating a Palestinian community, a country in the West Bank, as was once postulated by the United Nations in the partition resolution. Much more will be heard of these groups. But you assume, as so many do, that the headlines represent fact, that Israel is a nation beleaguered by hundreds upon thousands of terrorists daily crossing the border is sheer nonsense. There are terrorists. They have killed. They have planted bombs. They will kill more. They will plant more bombs. More of them will be killed. But ultimately, they do not represent a jugular threat to the survival of Israel any more than the carnage on our highways represents a jugular threat to the survival of this nation. You know, I don't think all of us recognize how much we are conditioned by ideas which have currency in the conventional wisdom. And I'm afraid that two ideas or two analogies have had a way of conditioning us to accept the possibility, the inevitability of the East finally overwhelming the West, of Israel's finally going under against the pressures imposed by the Arab world. The first of these analogies is the analogy to the Crusades. It was an analogy which was first suggested by the Arabs themselves. You remember that in the 11th century, in 1096, to be example, knights and barons and lords throughout the West took up the cross, moved by a desire to free the Holy Sepulchre from the Saracen infidel, moved by a desire for gold and for the great spices and trade in the Middle East, moved eastward, and were at first successful, captured Jerusalem, established a number of crusader kingdoms in Jerusalem, at Acre and Antioch and elsewhere, and how after some 50 years the East pulled itself together and first recaptured Jerusalem in 1143, and then within the next 100 years gradually limited more and more the scope of the crusader operation until Antioch fell and Acre fell, and finally into the end of the 13th century the West was no longer to be found in control of any city in the Middle East. This is what the Arabs have in mind when they say to Western diplomats, you better get on the right side. Yes, we lost the first round. Yes, we lost the second round. Yes, we lost the third round. We may even lose the fourth round, but there'll be a fifth and a sixth and a tenth, and ultimately, we won't lose. Now, all this is sheer nonsense. In the first instance, the 20th century is not the 12th century. History simply does not repeat itself. In the second instance, it was not the Arab world which reconquered the Crusader kingdoms, but the Turks. The Arabs were never able to pull themselves together. The Crusaders came upon the East in the early 12th century at the very tail end of the Shiite Fatimite Empire, which was centered in Egypt. And they, in a sense, destroyed that empire. And the Arabs were never able to build up another kingdom. Instead, Nur al-Din and Saladin, the Turks, the Seljuks, came down and conquered the Arabs, imposed their rule on the Arabs, and then began to attack the Crusader communities. And in the third instance, the Crusaders were and remained Europeans. Yes, a few Norman nobles remained in the East because they were given fiefs there. But most men, 90-95% of those who went to the East, went on for a tour of military enlistment to make their fortune, and after 3 years or 5 years or 7 years, returned to Normandy or to Brittany or to Germany or to England, and they had intended to return from the very beginning. And when the East could not provide the booty and the gold and the women, there was no reason to come out again. And little by little, the Crusader kingdoms were weakened. Israel, of course, is Israel. It's the home of the Jew, the ancestral home. And the Jews have cultivated the land in a way that the Crusaders never did. They're not there to abuse. They're not there to take booty. They're there because this is their national home. The analogy simply will not hold. And the other analogy which many make is the analogy to the guerrilla wars of national liberation which have taken place in our own lifetime. There's a certain romance to these wars of national liberation, especially among those who espouse third world philosophies. They look upon it as the wave of the future. They know that Mao Tse-tung waged a war of national liberation after the long march back into Hunan province, and that he is now master of the most populous country on the face of the earth. And we Americans know that Castro waged a guerrilla war of national liberation, and that he beat the troops of Batista, and that he is now master in Cuba. We know that the Algerians waged a war of national liberation against the French, and that a revolutionary Arab Algerian government is now master in that country. And so we assume that there's something about the 20th century, about that is contemporary, up to date, inevitable, about wars of national liberation that they must somehow win. And since the guerrillas and the Arabs have proclaimed a war of national liberation against Israel, somehow this must be, and that's sheer nonsense. The Hucks have been waging a war of national liberation against the Filipinos for 25 years, and they remain a small band of robbers and little more. Che Guevara, after the success in Cuba, tried to stimulate wars of national liberation in Ecuador and Bolivia, and he died in a futile effort. There have been other failures in the attempts to wage wars of national liberation. They are not inevitably successful because they depend upon certain conditions. The first is a massive indigenous population which believes itself abused by a feudal or colonial overlord. There were 1.5 million Cubans, and Batista had 60,000 police. There were 10 million Algerians, and the French had 350,000 troops. There were 600 million Chinese, and the Kuomintang could put only 5 million of its army into the field. But there are 2.5 million Israelis. And even if every Arab in the occupied territories were in fact sympathetic with a war of liberation and was willing to risk his life for it, there are only 1 million Arabs. And there is no Hunan province. There is no mountain fastness as there is in Cuba. There is no place where these people can hide during the initial stages of the war. And there is no country like Tunisia or Morocco, or no hinterland like Sinkiang and Siberia, where the people who are fighting the war can go to receive arms for relief from the battle and the pressures of war. Israel is not faced with a war of national liberation, whatever be the words which sometimes appear in the press. You can't create something simply by labeling it what you wish it to be. What you have in Israel was and remains a persistent, hateful, spiteful attack by nations which surround Israel, who call themselves Arab, though not all are, who are determined to wipe out Israel from the face of the Middle East because they consider her existence there an affront to their way of life or their hopes for the area. Now the future is uncertain. The future always is. Israel will have to find within herself resources of courage and determination and steadiness, economic and political and social. Perhaps beggar description now. But the point remains, I believe, But there is nothing inevitable about her destruction. There is nothing inevitable about the fact that she must ultimately be overwhelmed by the ocean people who are the Arab world. Let me suggest to you why I believe this. Let me suggest to you some of the hopeful possibilities which exist in the Arab world, some of the things for which Israel can be thankful. I don't say that any one of these will in fact eventuate. I merely say that they are all possibilities. Quite as real is the possibility of the iron noose of the Arabs closing as a vice on Israel. Most of us, when we think of the Middle East, think of the symbiosis of the East and of the Soviet Union. We think of the supply by the Soviet of men and materiel. We think of the actions by the actual armies of Egypt and Iraq and of Syria and of the guerrillas using these weapons. We see this as the pressure being mounted against Israel. How long will, in fact, the relationship between the Soviet Union and the Arab states last? If history repeats itself to any degree in the Middle East, we'll sometime soon see the Arab hand biting, Arab dog biting the hand that feeds it, as they have bitten the hand of the British, bitten the hand of the French, and bitten the hand of the Germans, and bitten the hand of every country which has attempted to lend economic support to the industrialization and the development of the Middle East. One of the least well-kept secrets in the Middle East is the tension, the actual physical battles which erupted between the Russian engineers at Aswan and the Egyptian overseers. Just 3 weeks ago, Mr. Nasser put in jail one of his defense minister whom he accused of a Soviet-sponsored plot to take over the government. Syria is already making overt and covert attempts to gain support from communist China to thumb her nose at Russia, whom she believes to be in too much of an agreement with the United States in the Middle East. There's every reason to believe that the Russians in time may either be preoccupied by their commitments elsewhere, particularly their concerns with China, or B, may find that the constant infusion of guns and wealth and credits into the Middle East is a undertaking which has lost its benefits for them. For what have they to gain from the Middle East? Their fleet is in the Mediterranean, as is ours. They have refueling bases in the Mediterranean, as we do. Do you think the Russians, any more than we do, want to sponsor the near bankrupt economies of Syria and of Iraq and of Egypt? Russia has nothing to gain by the reopening of the Suez Canal. She has all the oil she needs in her own lands, on lands which are immediately contiguous to her. She has everything to lose and nothing to gain if the Arabs become totally economically dependent upon her. She probably cannot afford it. And in time, her interests must run athwart the interests of various Arab leaders, as they did when Nasser invaded Yemen, as they did when Nasser began to undermine some of the countries of Black Africa, and they may do so again. There is no reason to assume that inevitably, for the years and the decades ahead, Russia will remain an uncritical sponsor, as she is now, of General Nasser's or the guerrilla war against Israel. And what of this unity of the Arab world? Is the Arab world really a monolithic agglomeration of communities who have only one set purpose, the destruction of Israel? The one thing that is sure about the Middle East is that there are deep, age-old internecine quarrels, vendettas, which have yet to be played out. The Hashemites in Jordan hate the Baaths in Syria. The Druzes and the Shiite Muslims and the Marcionite Christians in Lebanon are generally at each other's throats. The Black in the Sudan and the Muslim in the Sudan are in a bitter war from which only one can survive, as are the Kurds in Iraq and the government in Iraq. The Saudi Arabians do not consider the Egyptians to be Arabs, and the Algerians and the Egyptians are eager to undermine the royalist governments in Bahrain and the oil duchies in Saudi Arabia. When an Arab summit is achieved, it is always a shaky thing and quickly shakes itself down Because there is no unity, there is no basic friendship, religion or racial ancestry does not bind these people together. They're at each other's throats. And the only thing that holds them together is this one now exploited common concern for defeating Israel. Why do you think, for instance, that Saudi Arabia and Bahrain contribute monthly stipends to General Nasser and to the guerrilla war chests? Is it simply out of a burning desire to eradicate Israel? Probably they would like to see Israel go. But the real reason is that it is a bribe. A bribe designed to keep revolutionary terrorists out of Saudi Arabia, out of Bahrain, out of the oil duchies, where things are ripe for a revolution. How long will the revolutionaries stay quiet? How long will it be until the tensions erupt into open conflict? Actually, the Arabs are at each other's throats far more than they are at the throats of Israel. We saw this, as I indicated a few weeks ago, in the Lebanon. The issue in the Lebanon was not the issue of the guerrillas against Israel. It was the issue of the Syrian-sponsored guerrilla movement, the Al-Fatah, seeking to exploit an occasion in order to gain control of access routes towards Beirut in central Lebanon in order to complete in a few years, the next stage of the next, the overthrow of the present government, joint government of Christian and Arab and of Muslim Arab, and to bring it under the control of Syria. Arabs had all the freedom of movement along the northern border before the attack on Lebanon that they now have. What I am suggesting then is this: the tides of time run in many directions, and it is altogether understandable that if Israel can abide, can sustain itself, the group of power being forged against her may simply crumble from its own internal conflict, may turn against itself, rather than to be directed in a unified, uniform fashion against Israel. And there's a third factor in this internecine Arab quarrel, which is in Israel's favor. And that is the emergence of a Palestinian sense of identity. Now, it is not all guerrillas, and the terrorist groups are not all Palestinian, though they would like to lead the Palestinians, because the refugees represent the one group in the Arab world who have nothing to lose if they go and fight against Israel. But there are on the West Bank, there is in the East Bank too, a growing number of Palestinians, people who have long roots in the country, who look back now with some longing to 1947 and to the partition arrangement, and who can see the possibility of creating an independent state in the West Bank area, much as was envisaged by the United Nations 23 years ago. Now, this sword cuts two ways. In the first instance, the militant groups among the Palestinians have said to Jordan and to Lebanon and to Syria and Egypt, don't negotiate with the West, because if you do, we will cancel any agreements that you make. We have our own purposes, and they're not yours. And the militant leadership of these groups is Maoist and totally revolutionary and as much dedicated to the overthrow of Amman or Damascus or Beirut or Cairo as it is to establishing a power in the West Bank. But there are many more who say, look, the news dispatches which go west may say Israeli occupied West Bank, formerly Jordan. But the truth is that the West Bank was for years occupied by Jordan. It was never Jordanian. It was never intended to be. It was never intended to be part of the Hashemite Empire. The West Bank was intended to be Palestinian, and perhaps we can work out a modus vivendi with the Israelis who will allow us passage to the seaports for our goods, even as they now allow our workers to move freely throughout the country to earn the higher Israeli wages. Perhaps we can be a community bound together economically, at least, with Israel in common purpose. It will not happen tomorrow. It will not happen 10 years from now. But there are possibilities here of which the Israelis are fully conscious, and many of the notables on the West Bank are also fully conscious. What am I saying? Simply this, that the common innocent image that in the weight of the Soviet bloc and the determination of something unified called the Arab world must constantly lean against Israel until Israel finally breaks under the weight. The relationship of the Soviet to the Arab bloc is tenuous, that the unity of the Arab world is itself tenuous, and that in time, these internal stresses and strains can possibly be exploited for Israel's advantage. And there is one last thing that Israel can be thankful for, and that is that the tensions under which she finds herself have really permitted Israel to mature into a nation. Think back 3, 4, 5 years ago. What were we hearing? We were hearing about the Oriental problem in Israel, of the difficulties of acculturizing the Jew from Iraq, the Jew from Algeria, the Jew from Syria into the Israeli way of life. We were hearing about growing tensions among the 1 million Oriental Jews, feeling that the Western Jew, who had been there longer, had all the positions of authority, and was getting all the admissions to the Hebrew University and all the fine posts in the Histadrut, had every economic advantage, much as the white man has had traditionally in the United States. But what's happened in the last 3 years? For the first time, because the Oriental Jews came in after 1948 and most of them after 1956, for the first time the Oriental Jew and the Occidental Jew fought together and they are now fighting together. And the pressures under which Israel finds herself have coalesced the nation. Sure, there are lingering prejudices and there are still problems which must be solved, but there's a spirit now, a willingness to solve them. There's a sense we are all one. The Eastern Jew, Western Jew problem has tended to be faced in the last 36 months. And that's all to Israel's benefit. Because ultimately, she could survive, she can survive, only if 2.5 million Jews achieve what Jews have traditionally great difficulty of achieving, a sense of unity. We have a feeling of comradeship, but when we get together, each of us is a rugged individualist, and boy, we want to have our way. What is Israel to be thankful for? Herself, courage, the new sense of unity which has developed in Israel, the new sense of unity which has developed between the diaspora and Israel. I think none of us could have predicted 25 years ago as we faced the slow acculturation of Judaism into the Western world, as we faced the explosion of knowledge and the great pressures being placed upon Jews and non-Jews throughout the world, the great questions being raised about the validity of religion generally. None of us would have believed that the sense of common purpose which pervades Jews throughout the world would be as real, as vital, and as vigorous a fact as it in fact is. Oh yes, the little islands of Jews here and there who couldn't care less, but they're very few. Whether you go in South Africa, to the Argentine, whether you go to England or France or any place in this country, our communities are organized in support of those activities in Israel which we can in fact support. And we are eager, and we are sober, and we have been proven over 2 decades. And that's all to the good. And finally, Israel can be thankful for a new realism on her own part. 1967 brushed away all of the words, the paper arrangements, which had no bite to them. There were all kinds of diplomats in Israel and out who said, trust the West. There is a United Nations peacekeeping force. There are American, quote unquote, commitments to Israel. Do what we ask you, and the friendship and the understanding of the world will rescue you and rally to you. Well, the sympathy of the world is profuse, but the actions of the world are rare. Czechoslovakia has become a clear symbol to Israel of her own fate if she depends upon the goodwill of any State Department and not upon her own ability to survive. And that's why what the press likes to call the intransigence of Israel, the insistence on negotiations. And we cannot, Israel cannot depend upon the assumed meaning implicit in some State Department official statement, which may or may not be a commitment of American troops in this or that kind of situation, which may or may not arise within an indefinite period in the future. And we must understand this determination, because Israel faced death and destruction, and she had a great victory, but she faces death and destruction, and she cannot afford to put her faith in those forces which will not save and cannot be delivered. I think when you look reality in the eye, and you don't delude yourself that there are strengths and forces behind you which may not be there, you are far better equipped to deal with reality. When you accept your life for what it is, you have no false illusions about your grace or your charm or your power or your wisdom or the power of your family to pull you out of danger if you should fall into it, then and then only can you begin to lead a successful life. And what's true of a person is true of Israel. So Israel can be thankful that 1967, the inaction of the West, the French embargo, the sudden pulling out of the United Nations peacekeeping force, stripped her of all illusions about the realities of politics and have led to the new realism which dominates her policies today. In our Bible, we read that when Moses was about to turn over authority to Joshua, he gave him only two words of counsel. One was Chazak, the second, Amatz. Be strong and be of good courage. That's really the simple sermon that I think every Jewish leader should leave today. The times are hard. When have they not been? We are surrounded by those who do not understand. Has it ever not been true? We are ultimately dependent upon our own spiritual and physical force for survival. And when has that not been the case? But if we are strong and of good courage, if we do not accept the headlines as reality, but look the situation in its real terms of reality, then I think time may in fact be on Israel's side and ours. Certainly I know that there are many possibilities for security, for arrangement, for negotiation, for peace. Amen.